Yes, it is. This is the weekly show all about weather. Weather Brains episode number 327 for the 30th of April, 2012. Hey, I'm James Spann. Thanks a lot for taking the time to join us this week. It is time to talk a little weather. And man, do we, the brains are so massive on the show this week that the whole thing just might blow up.
Uh-oh, we have James. Hey, James.
Yes. Yes.
Breaking news.
Uh-oh.
We got the breaking news.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Yes.
Hey, I need to ask Chuck Doswell right out of the gate. Does he want to be email officer for this program?
No way, man.
You can't pawn that job off.
Chuck, look, I just had
say,
to ask.
Just say no.
Does it pay well?
No.
You know, I can be bought.
All right.
It's just that it's not cheap to buy me.
James, pull out your credit card.
This could be the greatest show in the history of Weather Brains. We do have the legendary Dr. Doswell. Well, we're going to formally introduce him here in just a minute.
All right, I'm sorry.
That's all right. But the guy that's causing trouble here at the top is Kevin Selly in Dallas-Fort Worth. Kevin, how are you?
I don't think I have anything else to say now.
No, that's all you've got.
No, we're fine. Big, ugly storms in West Texas on the dry line. And that's it. Just watching.
More the visible satellite shot was just gorgeous this evening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I love that in the afternoon. You get those overshooting tops, and it's just, boy, it's just gorgeous.
So, Chuck, how many West Texas dry line storms have you chased in your life?
I never kept count, but it's a bunch.
Yeah, I bet.
And I spent a lot of my early years chasing out in West Texas, so it's familiar territory to me. It's just that recently they haven't been very productive when I've been out chasing, so I haven't been back much.
I got about a million questions for you, and I'm not even supposed to be asking questions yet. We're gonna formally introduce you here in just a second. We've got J.B. Elliott, the world's greatest weatherman. J.B. used to trace storms on the West Alabama dry line back in the 1930s. Isn't that right, J.B.?
Well, I was mainly a fog chaser.
That's right. You chase fog, drizzle, and subsiding air, right?
Did I hear that earlier tonight there was a tornado warning for Greensburg, Kansas?
I do believe that is correct.
That might be.
I think there was,
There's some big stuff up in northern Oklahoma and southern Kansas. Mm.
Yeah, it's pretty active out there.
Went past Vance.
Hey, JB, you're back on Skype this week. You sound good. I understand Mr. Peters came out and fixed you up.
Yeah, the more I brought him a soft drink, the better he worked.
did you give him soft drinks, or did you give him some of that Buffalo Rock beer that you drink out there?
No, I'll let Brian tell you what he had. It was scrumptious.
So, Brian, what did you have?
Dr. Pepper 10. Never had it before.
So
Dr. Pepper 10 virgin until JB took me down that yellow brick road.
No, that's no good. That's no good. No good. Did you like it?
I beg to differ with you. I thought it was.
Did you like it really? Oh,
yeah.
I didn't like it.
All right. We'll do soft drink brains next week. That's Brian Peters, the internationally beloved meteorologist, a retired United States government employee.
Chuck and I have something in common.
Wow.
Yeah, we certainly do.
We're milking the federal government trough, right, Chuck?
Absolutely.
Hey, Chuck,
you guys are working hard so I can get paid. I appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
I'm with you there.
So, Chuck, when did you officially retire from NOAA?
It was in January 2001.
Really?
Wow.
Goodness. But, man, that's one of my 87 million questions down. Let's just bring in producer JP very quickly. Producer JP puts this show together, so any complaints about the length, like he has something to do with it. The hosts, email, anything. JP brought me a milkshake today, and I'm in a great mood because of that. JP, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Working on the e-forecast for tomorrow morning and looking at that really impressive couplet approaching the Vance Air Force Base radar site. Very, very impressive.
Yeah, it's got some active.
I'm enjoying some of that leftover New York strip as well. Very tasty from last night.
Mm. And I'm sitting here eating one of these junk hamburgers here.
I had a good lunch for a change.
Oh, well, let's hear it, JB. I forgot to ask. I'm sorry. What'd you have for lunch today?
I had one of those flat TV dinners that you can heat up and cook in only 60 seconds and it's ready to eat. It was beef stew, and I had a bowl of chicken and rice and a Dr. Pepper 10 to drink, two slices of whole wheat bread with peach preserve smeared across the top, and one more Dr. Pepper 10.
Mm. So you quit drinking this Buffalo Rock and you're on Dr. Pepper 10 now, huh?
Yeah.
All right. I'll have to try that. All right, but Bill, we have to formally introduce Dr. Doswell, and we've also got another guest panelist that you've got to introduce.
Yeah, James, joining the panel tonight is Ryan Hoke. He's an undergraduate meteorology student at Mississippi State and a weekend weather forecaster at WBBJ in Jackson, Tennessee. Ryan, welcome to the panel tonight.
Well, thanks, Bill, and thanks for having me on the program this evening.
Now, Ryan, you stay busy these days. Tell us real quick what's going on in your world, and we're going to visit with you in a little while after we visit with Dr. Doss. We'll talk about what's going on in your world.
Well, sure thing. Yeah, it's been busy lately, getting ready for final exams here at Mississippi State University, where I study meteorology here, broadcast and professional meteorology. I'm in my junior year, and of course, those final exams will be over for me on Wednesday, and I have to drive back to home, which is in Louisville, Kentucky, and then I get to fly out to Oklahoma City and then stay out in the plains for 3 weeks because I work for a storm-chasing tour company, and we take folks from all around the world out and about on the plains chasing storms and showing them what the weather's like here in the United States when it comes to extreme weather events.
Wow, that's exciting. Wow. Go ahead, whoever that was.
I just said, wow. It just went away.
Well, good. We'll visit with you in just a second, Ryan. But, of course, tonight's guest weather brain needed no introduction to our community of weather geeks. He appeared back on show 197 all the way in November 2009. Dr. Doswell, it was nice having you in Birmingham last week. It's nice having you on the show tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I certainly enjoyed visiting you all in Birmingham. And that's my first time ever in Birmingham, so I hope to come back sometime.
Well, tell us what your impressions were of the city as you visited for the first time.
Well, they kept us pretty busy. it was called a workshop, and they weren't kidding. We did a lot of arguing and so forth about research objectives for multidisciplinary research between meteorology and the social sciences. So I'm hoping that all the time we spent was productive, but I didn't get much tourist time.
Well, I know that you did get to eat some barbecue because I saw that famous hat in the window at Jim and Nick's on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
So tell us at least how the barbecue was.
I think the barbecue was fantastic. I would go back to Jim and Nick's in a microsecond. That was definitely very good stuff. And good service, too.
Well, good. We sure enjoyed that.
The classic Southern hospitality was in full display.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, one of the debates seemed to center pretty early in the workshop, Dr. Doswell, around what actually was the problem, sort of in quotes. Did you think we ever agreed on what the problem actually is?
Oh, hell
is?
No. No. You put that many scientists together, all you get is a lot of hot air generation.
And so that's why we're running 8 to 10 degrees above normal here in Birmingham right now, huh?
Yeah.
That may be the source. But seriously, it's really hard. I mean, we were really getting to know each other only for that 3-day period, and it takes a lot longer for sort of meaningful conversation to emerge out of first contacts. I think we did pretty well given the sort of handicaps of trying to do a lot in 3 days. But, and I think we made some progress. But as for the problem, I recently posted a blog, I don't know if you saw it, talking about last year's large death toll. And one of the things that I want to do right now is lay down the gauntlet and slap James around a little bit and say, I think he's dead wrong. Okay, it's not his fault. There's nothing that he could have done beyond what we are now doing. And to me, the real likely explanation for 600 fatalities is that we've been lucky for the last several decades, and our luck ran out last year.
Go Chuck!
And, And I just don't think that anything James did or did not do added or subtracted significantly to what happened.
You're getting a standing ovation from me.
Calm down, Brian. Calm down. Yes.
If you read my blog, I go into some detail about it, but I just don't think there are any magic fixes around. There's no particular wording that's going to turn the warnings into something different.
Amen!
And people aren't going to turn into these zombies that automatically go to shelter when we tell them what to do. That's not going to happen. So the answer to a 600 death toll, 600 fatality death count is a lot more complicated than just some tinkering with the wording.
Man, no. You are my man of the hour.
Yeah, this is going to be the greatest show ever. I've got about 90 million questions now.
Well, okay. Everybody jump in, and Ryan, you too, whenever you have one.
Before you start, I want to point out that today is the 40th anniversary of my first ever tornado.
Oh, wow.
Hey, wow.
Tell us about it, Chuck.
Yeah, it was. I started chasing on the 18th of April in 1972, and I thought, you know, gosh, I'm never going to see a tornado. And on the 30th of April, we chased out in extreme western Oklahoma, almost in the Texas panhandle. And we got on a real nice storm, and I looked at it, and I said, this thing is going to produce a tornado. I didn't know how or why. I didn't understand. I'd never seen a storm that was behaving that way. It turned out it was a very nice classic supercell. And so that was my first supercell. And while we were watching, it spun down a brief, you know, maybe five-minute tornado. That nevertheless sort of validated everything that I'd ever wanted to do with storm chasing. It was kind of a fun day, to say the least. I finally popped my cherry, so to speak.
Kind of like Brian with his Dr. Pepper 10 today, kind of.
Yeah. Now, it was quite a good experience.
What did you know about supercells then, and what came after that? So I guess Browning had defined what a supercell was, but
sure.
Was that really an understood concept in that day?
It was poorly understood, and I think certainly on my part it was poorly understood. I'd read the papers and seen the illustrations, but I really had no personal conception of what a supercell was going to look like, in spite of the fact that there were some pictures floating around, and certainly like the Fargo tornado of 1957 had been thoroughly documented. I never dreamed I would see anything even remotely like that. And so when I finally saw the storm on the 30th of April, 72, I just knew that it was something special, and it was unquestionably a supercell. And one of my colleagues was advocating that we pick up and go, and I said, like hell, we're not going anywhere, you know, just wait. And a few minutes later, we saw the tornado, so I was quite correct in insisting that we stay where we were. But it was kind of a strange experience to have that sense that I'm seeing something special that for the first time, and so that was pretty exciting. Yeah, it took me about a week to come down from that.
And you were only, what, 9 years old when you did this, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's right.
I was in graduate school.
Now, a year later, the Union City, Oklahoma tornado was very important. Chuck, and you had some role in that, didn't you?
Yeah, well, we were an independent chase team. At that point, I wasn't chasing in the same semi-official capacity I did to see my first tornado. We were just a bunch of grad students that got together and went out chasing, and we made some tactical mistakes, but we were able to recover by core punching, which, by the way, was when I made a personal decision not to do any more core punching. when I got to thinking about it, I realized that if we had arrived 10 minutes earlier, we would have driven out of the rain and hail right into the tornado, which probably would not have been a good thing. And but at any rate, we saw the tornado as it was leaving town, and we drove right into the damage path without first realizing it. And then we looked around, and people were starting to come up out of their Frady holes and so on. It was quite an unnerving experience, and actually caused me to go through a lot of sort of personal anxiety, because for the first time I sort of understood that, hey, this isn't just some fun exercise. These things do bad things to people. And, you know, we're looking at all this destruction and damaged lives. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm out here wishing for this stuff to happen. Yes. So I had to kind of rethink where I was coming from on all of this. And I finally reconciled it, obviously, because I'm still chasing storms. I realized that what I wanted to happen had absolutely no influence on what the atmosphere actually did. So it really wasn't my fault that a tornado went through Union City. And by being there and contributing to the research, then perhaps in the long run, the things that we've done since then have, in a sense, kind of repaid society and given something back to society for the fun we had. So I don't feel too bad about that.
Well, and your work, Chuck, has gone a lot further, because you influenced me. You and Al Mohler influenced me when I was at the regional office in Fort Worth, and I ended up training over 6,000 storm spotters in Central and North Alabama, and it was your work that really, I mean, I didn't take credit for your work, but your work was the bulk of what I used to try to educate storm spotters about what they're seeing. So,
sure. Well, and I have to thank my colleague and longtime friend Al Mohler for showing me a very nice and satisfying mechanism for feeding something back into society through the spotter training. He really was very influential on me.
Yeah.
And convinced me that this was the right thing to do. This was something that was needed. And because the spotting that was around before the mid-70s was pretty lame, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, Al was definitely in the right place at the right time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And by the way,
how is Al and Chuck? I'm sorry.
Yeah, how's he doing, Chuck?
Well, I have to say that the last time I spoke with him, I think he's kind of going downhill slowly. I don't know if you're aware of his situation, but it's not such that he's incapacitated yet, but each time I see him, he's declined a little bit more, and that's really difficult for me to see, because obviously he's always been and will always be a close friend.
Yeah.
Now, Brian was standing on the sidelines cheering when you were talking a moment ago, and that's a cause he's taken up over the past several weeks. We've discussed the Central Regions experiment several times, and do you see that as a knee-jerk reaction, Chuck?
Well, I posted about that in my blog also. The way I describe it is it's an ill-advised, ill-conceived experiment.
Yes, go Chuck. Hey, Chuck, if you haven't listened to Weather Brains, I was the one who made the Central Region director hang up on us.
Well, I was talking to someone in the Weather Service in Birmingham, and he was, I forget who it was, and I wouldn't mention his name anyway.
Oh, come on, tell me.
But he asked me about what I thought about it, so, you know, when people ask me that question, I normally comply with that request, and I told him what I just said, and then I expanded on it in some detail about what was ill-advised and what was ill-considered. And it's just not a good thing, and I wish they weren't doing it, but obviously they're determined to go ahead. The thing that worries me the most is that, in some sense, I'm an advocate of the concept of tiered warnings, of having graded threat levels. We aren't always at a fever pitch. Yeah. And I think meteorologists can, in the long run, make some reasonable assessment of the situation and put out a warning that reflects their assessment of the situation at the time. Now, the fact that I believe that, and they're out there dinking around with this experiment, I have a bad feeling that they're going to, in effect, I don't know how to describe this in a nice way, so I'll maybe poison the waters.
Yes.
By fooling around with this idea prematurely and in a very clumsy, not very well-considered way, they may make it difficult for us eventually to implement what I think needs to be implemented. So I'd rather they weren't doing it.
I'm with you.
Now, the false alarm...
They don't listen to me very much anymore. If they see my name, it goes automatically into the shredder. And from my perspective, I'm kind of proud of that, actually.
I'm not so sure, but what? I don't have good company then, Chuck, because I'm not so sure my name isn't going in the shredder, too.
Well, you know, I think if you haven't pissed somebody off lately, you're not doing your job.
What? Show title.
I really agree with you. You know, after 36 years in the Weather Service, I mean, my God, if we aren't there to try to tell people and get the urgency, but like you say, there's events that there is an urgency because we don't have the reports, we don't have the information, you know, but to go to something like this when we really don't have the skill to do that at this point, you know, and as I pointed out, a couple of weather brains ago.
I think it would have been better. I think we probably do have the skill to do that, but of course not perfectly.
Right, right.
And what I suggested was that before they did some kind of public experiment where they're sending this out to real people, they should have gone through some exercises of testing it purely internally. Yes. To establish how good they are at it. And, you know, forecasters, if they haven't done something like this before, it takes them a certain amount of time to be calibrated. If you go back to the introduction of probability of precipitation, we now take it for granted that most forecasters are reasonably well calibrated in this. That is, their perception of the increasing threat of precipitation corresponds reasonably accurately with the increasing probability of having an event happen. And so, but that takes time. Forecasters often, when they first begin to do something, are overly optimistic about their ability to say absolutely yes or no. So they have to calibrate themselves. And so in order to get the best possible product to put in front of the public, which is what I would hope we're trying to do, we need to have people play with this for a while internally and learn how to do it effectively and accurately.
I'm with you.
And that wasn't done. And, you know, there are lots of venues where that kind of experiment could have taken place before they made the ill-advised decision to go public with this thing. I think they are, in fact, knee-jerk reacting to last year. I mean, if you ask me, and you haven't, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
Go.
If you ask me, NOAA and NWS management are so inept as to be abysmally bad. They're basically responding to pressure from somebody or perceived pressure. And so, you know, they go off half-cocked on these things. They want to be able to say they're doing something. So then they say, well, you know, we're conducting this experiment. Well, fine, but it was a stupid thing to do. And so bragging about doing something stupid seems kind of, you know, counterproductive to me.
Is it a move to fend off budget cuts, though, Chuck?
You know, when I was in the government, I used a bad word.
Just lost our clean rating.
When I was in the government, we were threatened with budget cuts for the entire 32 years I worked for them.
Yes.
There was never a time when we weren't under the sword of Damocles hanging over our heads.
Me too.
And So the idea of reacting to these gusts of wind that blow through the federal bureaucracy is just stupid. But, of course, many of the people who are in charge are dilettantes who really don't know anything about what life is like in the trenches. And maybe they're inexperienced. Some of them are even, God forbid, political appointees. And, you know, these boneheads haven't got a clue. So it's not surprising that they would go off half-cocked.
Chuck, I think you've succeeded in making Weather Brains an off-limits show for all weather services.
Well, we've already made the central region guy hang up on us, so it doesn't matter, Brian. I mean, you paved the way for this.
Well, and we've got titles for the next six episodes. So.
The guys in the trenches are people that I have enormous respect for. And many of them are my friends, and I admire very much the things that they're trying to do on behalf of the public. The problem is that they have leadership that is not worthy of the name leadership. And so you have all these problems.
Now, something that James is pretty passionate about, Chuck, and you expressed your opinion on it when you were here, but talk about the false alarm problem in air quotes.
Right. Right. Well, a certain amount of false alarm is essentially inescapable. The problem with false alarms is partly related to the fact that we're not allowed to say anything about, I know the dreaded P word, the probability of a tornado. So instead, we have to say either we're issuing a tornado warning or it's not. We're either black or white. That's a categorical product, a dichotomous product. It has only two options. Either we issue a warning or we don't. And the problem is that there is an asymmetric penalty function. What that means is that if you have something out and nothing happens, that's a false alarm. If you don't have something out, and God forbid something happens, then the federal investigative teams are going to descend on you and want to know why you didn't have something out. There's a much stronger penalty for failing to have a product out. And so what happens is forecasters aren't stupid. They understand the asymmetric penalty function. They know they're under greater pressure not to miss an event. So they over-forecast. There is a natural pressure because of this asymmetric penalty function for forecasters to have a strong bias toward over-warning. If we could put out a graded threat, where if we were not so sure, but there's still enough signs that we're a little worried about it, we could put out a relatively low probability, but it's not zero. And then, you know, when you're dealing with a Tuscaloosa 2011, that's when you go up to the top of the charts. And that way, forecasters can actually express what they see happening in the weather, which is what I would like to see us be able to do.
Let me play devil's advocate, though. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I would love to play here.
All right.
About the, yeah.
I know what you're going to say.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, say it anyway.
I will. Would that increase the cry wolf thing where people just don't hear it anymore?
Well,
the warning fatigue.
If we talk about graded threat levels.
Yeah.
Then what we can do is issue a product that is unbiased on the average. We can actually talk about our understanding, our assessment of the threat. And since it varies from situation to situation, you may feel obligated to put out some kind of a warning when there's a supercell with a mid-level mesocyclone approaching a big populated area because you're concerned about the threat. So, but you won't put out the, oh my God, the apocalypse is about to descend on the city kind of warning. You put out a much lower level of threat. And in my opinion, I think the public can handle that.
Fascinating.
I think they would handle it a lot better than dinking around with the wording in our warnings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One question that occurred to me, you may or may not be familiar with the Oklahoma City weather situation, but here in Oklahoma City, we have what we call the weather wars between the major stations in Oklahoma City. And they are trying to outdo one another in terms of if a storm is approaching the metropolitan area, to spread the word of the approaching end of all mankind in central Oklahoma. I often wondered what it would take, what they would do if we actually had a really serious threat. Well, what happened was May 3rd, 1999, and curiously enough, I think I've heard some interesting feedback from people. There are two factors that changed the response toward a more positive response. One was the fact that the body language of the broadcasters made it very clear that this was not the ordinary apocalypse. This was the real apocalypse.
This was breaking news, as Kevin says.
that actually had some impact. And, of course, there's the famous special wording that Dave Andra introduced, the so-called tornado emergency. Now, as soon as I heard tornado emergency, two things. One, it conveyed that this was an unusual situation, and everybody understood that. But, of course, what I also foresaw, and which, in fact, has happened, is a lot of tornado emergency-type warnings have been issued where there wasn't even a tornado that verifies that warning, much less an F5. So it's been overused and used stupidly. And it's a good example of how tinkering with the wording doesn't work. As soon as you put in new wording, it becomes the old wording after you overuse it. And it's just unfortunate that's the way things go. The whole problem with trying to convey, I think, by the way, one of the things that certain people told me that happened during the April 27, 2011 outbreak was when James rolled up his sleeves, everybody figured, oh, my God, we're all going to die.
It just meant I was hot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, somehow that act conveyed something to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think James has anything to be ashamed of or to blame himself for about the death toll. When you put a violent tornado through a populated area with poorly constructed homes, the sad fact is that at the moment, we're not doing what it takes to prevent that kind of event from producing fatalities. It has nothing to do with the meteorology, in my opinion. We do a great job with putting out warnings for long-track violent tornadoes. When you're able to show live video, for Pete's sakes, only a moron or somebody without a television is sitting around saying, well, do you think we ought to do something? You know, I mean, there's a pretty strong message in that kind of product, and yet people died.
So you think it's a societal issue and not a science issue then?
Yeah. The meteorology, sure, we can improve the meteorology. There's no question of it. And, you know, it's harder to reduce the false alarm problem. You know, I would hope that the introduction of graded threat levels would cause forecasters to be less biased in their products. And hopefully that would do something to modify the false alarm problem. But if you're going to change the false alarm problem, you have to change the meteorology at a very fundamental level. And so that means we have to have what amount to breakthroughs that are very difficult to engineer or anticipate. You can't say, oh, well, you know, we'll spend $1 billion and have a breakthrough next week. That's not the way it works.
Yeah.
Breakthroughs aren't something you can manufacture. And at the moment, if we want to make a serious improvement, a serious change,
in our warning accuracy, we need to do two things. One, we need to train our Weather Service forecasters better. And in the case of the National Weather Service, the Weather Service has what amounts to absolutely no substantial training program for its forecasters. So are we surprised when there's spotty performance out in the field? I'm not. But, you know, we can improve that with training, but if we're going to make sort of real fundamental changes in the false alarm problem, we have to change the science at its core. And that's a much tougher problem.
Yeah. Chuck, I got to swerve into your thoughts on social media, the proliferation of weather information on blogs and Twitter and Facebook. You must have some thoughts there.
Well, I guess my thought is caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. There's a vast amount of misinformation going out in social media and over the internet in general, just like there's vast amounts of misinformation going out over the regular broadcast media. Ultimately, people have to spend some time to try to track down and sift the wheat from the chaff. It's not so easy as tuning into your favorite broadcaster. Much as I love James, and James puts out a great deal of good stuff, he also puts out a certain amount of misinformation. And he and I have disagreements about certain things. And in my opinion, that's putting out misinformation. The public has to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, and it's not easy. It's not easy for a practicing scientist to do that. But if you want to get information, you don't just grab the first source and say, well, that's the authoritative source. You have to work at it. People have to learn how to think for themselves. And quite honestly, at times when I look at students and coming into our university programs, I kind of despair. It seems like nobody has been teaching them how to think for themselves. It's discouraging.
But, well, Dr. Doswell,
this is the problem. Go ahead.
Okay. On that note, I want to ask you, do you think that a lot of folks are even reading the warnings? This is going back to, you know, changing up the wording and such. And you were talking about the current generation of students that's, you know, coming into college. And I'm sort of in that generation at the moment. And I see a lot of folks, you know, especially of my age, just want to know sort of a binary answer. Am I under a warning? Am I not? They're not really into seeking that much more information. But in your experience, do you find that people are reading the warnings? And if so, would maybe a tiered warning system, as you alluded to, would that make them more likely to do that?
Great questions. My experience is, look, I'm a meteorologist. I've learned about differential equations, computer programming, drawing weather maps. As soon as I get into the topic of what people are thinking, I have no clue. I'm not a social scientist. I'm not a psychologist. I have no idea. And up until recently, essentially nobody has any idea what people are doing with the products we issue. So we need to do some research to find out more accurate information rather than saying, and I've been hearing this all my life, meteorologist X is sitting around in the office, we're having a bull session, and this meteorologist says, well, I think people need this, or I think people want that. Well, the operative word is think, right? That's what this person thinks. But does this person have any information to back that up? I'm trying to be a scientist and say, if I'm going to make a decision about how to interact with people, I would like to do so on the basis of some factual information. That's why this social science research needs to be done. If we're going to produce products that are effective in reaching the people who need effective information and have them reading things with the idea of actually obtaining information from it, then we have to know a lot more about how people deal with what we give them now. And mm-hmm. if we're gonna mess around with that system, with what we're giving them now, we need to be as reasonably confident that by messing around with it, we aren't going to screw it up. Mm-hmm. Because the existing warning system, despite its flaws and imperfections, has saved thousands of lives over the years.
Yes.
It's not a completely broken system. And if we start messing around with it, we could break it. So I say leave it the hell alone until we have a solid database, some solid research that says this is what we should be doing rather than what we're doing now.
So, Chuck, did you walk away from Birmingham after listening to some of these social scientists talk, thinking that, maybe they did perceive the problem and maybe have a way to at least get to the answers?
Well, I think they have the technical things that I lack. If I were going to go out and conduct a survey, I would probably write survey questions in such a way that I would bias the survey results. And these guys are familiar with how to do that kind of work, and so hopefully they can teach us how to do it. The problem that they have, and I heard this, and I got some really interesting negative feedback about it, they're sitting around sort of pontificating that, you know, we need to consider every little special interest group in this country. And I'm thinking, all right, well, how many languages are spoken in the United States by non-native speakers, people that have recently arrived in the U.S.? Well, there's a big Hispanic population, so we could target that population pretty easily and have a meaningful impact in a lot of people's lives if we put out products in Spanish. Right? But what about Poles? What about Lithuanians? What about Uzbekistanis? You know, there's all sorts of people out there. Can we have 180 different versions of the warning in all the different languages? I just think that's not workable. The Weather Service in particular has to put out a product that they have to assume is one size fits all, more or less. And there are some pretty strong limits on what you can do with that kind of limitation. Now, the private sector could jump in on some of these things and do quite a bit. And I would say that there's a lot of room in the system for the private sector to develop, in effect, translations of products, not necessarily language translations, but technical translations for various specialized users that would be very helpful, and they could, in effect, turn a profit as a consequence. So, you know, I think there's some potential there for some very interesting applications of market research and so on to find targeted audiences.
Now, one of the instructions...
Go ahead.
You go ahead here.
Well, the Weather Service can only do so much. They have to serve everybody equally. And in reality, what that means is you get kind of plain vanilla stuff that is very broad, generalized, and we really can't do any of this tailoring of products in the Weather Service. So one of the things that I think the Weather Service can and should do is spend a great deal more effort in what I would call outreach. You're familiar with the call to action statements and warnings, where the warning includes some statement to the effect, if you live in a mobile home, do this, and if you're here, do that. The time to be telling people what they need to do in a tornado situation is not in the last 10 minutes before the tornado hits them. And in those call-to-action statements, you're going to have to decide, well, which segments of the target audience are we trying to reach with these? Because you can't put out enough call-to-action statements to serve all of the diverse needs that are out there. So, personally, I don't think the Weather Service has any business telling anybody what to do. The Weather Service should provide information to people and let them decide what to do with it. Let them make their own choices. But what we can do to help them make their choices is all sorts of public information statements and so on. By the way, I think the broadcast media have dropped the ball almost totally on that in terms of helping to educate the public about their options. There's a tremendous opportunity that the broadcast media have with their dedicated followers in their audiences to pass on detailed information about situation awareness and things that people should be aware of and know how to do. One of the things that drives me bananas when I watch citizen video is you're looking at the video and you see a tornado going across the screen from left to right, and the guy says, "It's headed right for us!" And I'm going, "What? It's not headed for you. You can see it's going left to right, you bozo." And I'm just puzzled as to how people can make that mistake. Because that's a fairly important mistake. If you don't know which way it's moving, you don't know whether you're in the path or not. And for me, it's extremely obvious when I look at a tornado which way it's moving. And so it's relatively easy for me to stay out of the path, among other things. And I puzzle and I wonder why people are struggling with that. But if you're not aware of which way the tornado is moving, you can't make good choices. So, for example, if you're driving down the road, and, you know, this is a common question that I get from people, what do you do when you're driving down the road? Okay, well, the traditional message has been, you know, bail out of your car and jump in a ditch, which I think is good advice if that's your only option. But you remember the April 26, 1991, the tornado outbreak in Kansas, mm-hmm. where the TV station videoed a tornado headed toward the overpass, and they got people to take shelter under the overpass.
Yeah.
Okay. Kansas, well, if you look at that video. Okay, the tornado is approaching. Now, how fast is that tornado moving? Well, you may not know, but it was about 35 miles an hour. There is no conceivable way that a tornado moving at 35 miles an hour can catch a car on the bloody interstate. Unless you're doing 30 miles an hour down the interstate, which is illegal.
Below the minimum. Yeah.
Except for JB, I think he drives that speed.
So the whole situation that you see unfold in that video was manufactured by that news team. It wasn't catching them. There was no threat from that tornado. If they had wanted to escape it, they just step up to the normal speed limit, and they would have driven away from it. So they manufactured that situation. All right? If you see a tornado and you're not sure about how fast it's moving, okay, fine. If you have any uncertainty, you can always jump out of your car and jump into a ditch. But for many people, if you're not caught in a traffic gridlock situation, driving away from a tornado is easy, as long as you know which way it's moving. If you can move at right angles to its path, you can drive out of the path in about 10 seconds.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no excuse in many situations where you're not caught in a traffic jam that you can escape a tornado. What I worry about, of course, is where you have an F5 tornado going down an interstate in a city that's gridlocked at rush hour. And you have thousands of vehicles that can't go anywhere. And the tornado was just going around spewing vehicles in all directions. Mm-hmm. That's a nightmare scenario. And there's no reason that I know of that it can't happen. And if we wait long enough, it will happen.
All right, Chuck, we're running out of time. Let me ask you this one. Here's a headline, all right? Emergency all right. officials to storm chasers, stay home. Did you see that one?
Oh, yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this?
My thought is I'm not going to chase where there are hordes of chasers. If I'm out chasing and I see one of these chaser convergences, I just get the hell out of there. I have no interest in adding to that mess.
Do you think we've got too many of these guys running around out there now that don't know what they're doing?
Absolutely. Many of them are so clueless, they don't know they're clueless.
I like that.
That's pretty clueless.
Well, it's been demonstrated by careful scientific studies that clueless people have no clue that they're clueless.
Yeah. And see, you learned that only on this show. So is this just even like, it seemed like this big outbreak on the plains, what, a couple of Saturdays ago? You know, in some communities, there were more chasers than residents. Is this trend just going to keep going this way? We're just more and more Joe Q public guys get out there trying to make YouTube videos to make money?
Well, of course, if they think they're going to make big money, they're going to be sadly mistaken.
Absolutely.
But, and if they're going to get their 15 minutes of fame, chances are it won't even amount to 15 minutes. But I think it's become kind of what I would call a trash sport. The popularity of Twister, we saw a surge in these Yahoos. And the Discovery Channel program has only magnified that. Every pea-brain teenager looks at that and says, oh, gosh, that looks exciting. I want to do that. And gets out there, doesn't have an idea what the hell he's doing. They're driving around like atomic particles in Brownian motion, just randomly going, stopping, starting, turning. And I watch law enforcement looking at that, and they're shaking their heads in despair. And I think eventually they're just going to start arresting people.
Hey, did you watch Reed Timmer's program when it was on?
No, I refuse to watch that program.
Why?
I refuse to sanction that nonsense. It was nothing but a soap opera. It had nothing to do with science or discovery. It was all manufactured for TV. The amusing part is that Reed probably thinks he exploited the TV.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
So I guess it's safe to say you're not one of the subscribers to Reed's new internet channel, then, are you?
He has an internet channel?
I guess that kind of
another show title.
I am completely indifferent to whatever he does or whatever.
So you're saying what he did didn't really help the storm chasing business?
No. Well, he's one of those guys that has promoted this idea of storm chasing as some sort of extreme thing, where they're teetering on the brink of death. And that the only reason to be chasing is so that you can have near-death experiences. And, that's not true for 80 to 90% of the chasers out there. But it certainly conveys an image of storm chasing that is coincident with the perception that storm chasers are lunatics. And so anything that supports that notion, and Reed's program has done that. Anything that supports that is something that I'm just not going to support myself. I don't believe in it. It puts chasers in a bad light, and I'm a chaser, so I'm in effect basking in the putrid light of that kind of nonsense.
How often do you go out these days, Chuck?
Well, I'll spend a week out with a tour company as a paid lecturer and tour guide. I do that for a week, and then I go out for on the order of 2 to 3 weeks.
Cool. You've been watching this thing up in Medford tonight? That's a pretty wicked-looking storm.
Yeah, I was watching it before you guys called.
Yeah, it looks like something might have happened up there, so that's pretty bad. All right, guys. Yeah, we've got to move on. Anybody else have any pressing, probing questions for Dr. Doswell here?
I got one last one.
Go.
It says on your Wikipedia page, what's the juke joint?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I have an internet radio program that is a blues program, and it's once a month on ShockNet Radio.
All right.
If you like the blues, it's a lot of fun, and you know, it's 2 hours of essentially continuous music.
Awesome.
In the blues genre. I love blues.
How do you keep the RIAA from suing you guys for playing that stuff? See, we can't play music on this show.
Well, the station owner pays a fee.
Okay. Wow, you're legal.
So he's legal.
And let's plug the show that you do with Gene Roden. Just plug away, man.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of fun with that. We're going to have Chris Novy on Wednesday. Of course, Chris has been on several times, and Chris is a great guest, and so we'd like to have a lot of fun. He's a lot of fun to interview. He's a good guest to have.
Yeah, Chris was on our show last week.
Last week?
Yeah, I hope that people will tune in. We have a somewhat uninhibited program, as James can kind of guess.
But it's called High Instability, and you guys do this, is this every week? It seems like most every week you're there, right?
Every other week, but Gene has a lot of commitments on his time, and so sometimes he has to beg off.
Okay.
So it's kind of sporadic, but the goal is to have it more or less every other week.
So one more question. Grade the Storm Prediction Center and how they're doing in your eyes these days, their performance.
Well, I think they're the best severe storm forecasters on the planet.
I do, too.
And I have a great deal of respect for them. They're not perfect. But collectively, you can't find a better bunch. I count it a privilege to have many of them as friends of mine.
Awesome.
They're a great group.
Yeah, their work has been just exemplary here in the last, through my whole career for 30-something years. All right, so let's plug
I'm proud to have influenced a couple of them.
Well, you started me. I would sit in my office and read Severe Convective Storms, these preprints of all your papers. See, you wrote me into this. You wrote Peters into this. It's all your fault.
It's your fault.
Yeah.
Hey, I'll take the blame for you guys.
All right, good. But we'll plug your blog. For folks who want to go to your blog, how do they find it? Other than a search engine.
It's CADIII blogspot.com.
All right, and we'll put a link up on our website, weatherbrains.com. But, hey, Chuck, thanks for taking the time to come on the show this week. You're the best, you know that, and we love your...
Plug your images site, too, the C. Doswell. Put on Chuck's radio program, the Juke Joint, and then go to the outdoor images section of his website, and you will get lost in an amazing amount of fabulous pictures.
Right, that's at cdoswell.com.
Fantastic.
Cool.
Yeah,
all right.
It's a lot of fun.
All right, Chuck. Well,
thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks again. Hey, you have a great week. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. We'll see you.
All righty.
Okay, bye. Bye. All right, Brother Bill Murray, want to talk about Audible.com very quickly?
Yeah, James, do you remember Markham McEwen, who was on CBS The Morning Show a few years ago?
Yep.
Yeah, he was a weatherman, and he had a stroke a couple of years ago, and it's a pretty interesting story, and I came across his book this morning on Audible. It's just one of the 100,000 titles that you can get on there, and Mark is going to join us in a few weeks to talk about his weather career and his experience after having a stroke, so it'll be real interesting to have him on, but it's just, again, an example. For many of us, it's difficult to find time to read, and Audible allows you to take the time to do that by combining time where you would just be in a monotonous activity, like, say, driving or walking the dog or maybe doing housework or, you know, running or exercising, something like that. Audible gives you a chance to take that time and turn it into productive time, and you get these really entertaining titles. We've got a special deal for you here at WeatherBrains. If you go to audibletrial.com/weatherbrains, you'll get one free title and a 30-day free trial. You don't have to buy anything. You can quit at the end of that if you don't like it, but you can take that title, download it onto any device that you've got, and it's yours to keep, through the period. It's your book. And I think you'll really, really like it. But if you go to audibletrial.com/weatherbrains, if you like it, then you can either go onto the regular plan, the gold plan, which is a reasonable amount per month for just one title, or you can upgrade to the platinum plan, which is just under $23 a month, and get two titles. And you bank those titles, you can use them anytime, and they're, again, all yours always to keep. But go to audibletrial.com/weatherbrains, and you'll help the show here continue to be on the air with great guests like Chuck Doswell each week.
And you'll get that feel-good feeling for supporting us. I mean, it's just a feel-good kind of feeling. We're going to break for Weather Brains 101 this week in weather history. We'll come back with a fog bag picks of the week. Fog bank.
Is that something new?
Yeah, it is. It's a new segment this week.
It's like the fog back.
Yeah, the fog back, the fog bank. Well, I have picks of the week, email inbox, everything else. So just hang on. We got a lot more to go on this week's Weather Brains as we roll along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
You can probably tell from many of my picks that I'm fond of the view from space. Seeing the big picture has always fascinated me. The world's first meteorological satellite was launched from Cape Canaveral on April the 1st, 1960. Named TIROS for Television Infrared Observation Satellite, it demonstrated the advantage of mapping the Earth's cloud cover from above. There are basically two types of satellite views, POS, or polar orbiting satellites, which are about 500 miles above the Earth, and geostationary, or GOES, satellites located about 22,000 miles above the Earth. So why two types, and how do they compare? Polar orbiting satellites operate closer to the Earth, which provide more detailed images as well as excellent views of polar regions. The primary disadvantage comes from their orbital paths, which change due to the rotation of the Earth, so there are no two images from the exact same location. Geostationary satellites have the distinct advantage of being able to see half of the entire Earth in one view. Another big advantage is that the view never varies, allowing computations of cloud motions. Images from GOES satellites can be recorded as fast as 1 per second, and because of their positions, these satellites can collect data from buoys, free-floating balloons, and other remote data collection sites. On the flip side, the distance, which provides many of the advantages of GOES satellites, also becomes a disadvantage because images are not as detailed as those from POES. Positioned over the equator, GOES satellites have a very limited view of polar regions due to the Earth's curvature. Well, fortunately, we do not have to choose one or the other. Both types are in use. Chances are the ones you view most often come from the GOES satellites. Do you suppose if we got a tracking device attached to Mr. Span, we could make any sense out of his movements? Woo! If you have a weather question, drop an email to question@weatherbrains.com.
On the morning of May 4th, 2007, it was evident that an outbreak of severe weather was imminent across the plain states of the U.S. The Storm Prediction Center realized the threat and posted a moderate risk outlook for the region from the Texas Panhandle and western Oklahoma into Kansas and Nebraska. A powerful upper-level trough was over the west, with strong low pressure over Colorado and very moist Gulf of Mexico air being drawn northward. Instability values during the day went sky high, with Cape values running as high as 5,500 joules per kilogram. An approaching dry line triggered supercell thunderstorms during the evening from north Texas to southwestern Kansas. With plenty of wind shear, the storms quickly became severe. One tremendous supercell storm formed about 5 p.m. in the Texas Panhandle and moved northeast. Cape values were at 5,200 joules per kilogram over southwest Kansas, and the 0 to 2 kilometer helicity was 240 meters per second squared, meters squared per second squared. This made the EHI an amazing 7.8. Now, readings over 2 are nearly always associated with big tornadoes. The storm that had this environment producing it would bear 20 tornadoes during its long life, including 4 massive tornadoes that were on the ground continuously for 3 hours. The largest tornado in the family touched down in Comanche County, Kansas at 9:03. It crossed into Kiowa County a short time later. The first tornado warning for Comanche County was issued at 8:13, and the first for Kiowa County at 8:55. Now, another tornado warning was issued at 9:19 that specifically mentioned Greensburg, Kansas. and stated that it was a confirmed tornado. A call was placed to Kiowa County. Emergency management immediately began sounding the sirens. The massive tornado entered the south side of Greensburg at 9:45. It plowed directly through the heart of the town and its tree-lined streets. It took several minutes for the giant lawnmower of a storm to roar through the town, and when it was done, 95% of Greensburg lay in ruins. When it was all over, virtually nothing was left standing in the 1.7-mile path through the town. Now, the Greensburg tornado was the first to be rated as an EF5 on the new enhanced Fujita scale that had just been implemented, and the first tornado rated at the top of the scale since the Oklahoma City tornado in May of 1999. Winds were estimated at 205 miles per hour. Now, the warnings from the National Weather Service, dissemination from the media, and coordination with emergency management was superb. Siren sounded 24 minutes before the twister struck. Now, countless lives were spared by the advance warnings, but still 11 people died in the horrific destruction, some in basements. The disaster presented the town officials and residents in Greensburg with a unique opportunity to rebuild. The leaders are choosing to do it in a green manner using environmentally friendly practices. That's a look back at a terrible tornado that occurred during This Week in Weather History. Follow my weather history tweets on Twitter. I am WXHistorian at twitter.com.
Yes, Bill Murray doing that live.
And I'm hoping I'm going to have a weather history tonight in Medford, Oklahoma, James.
Yeah, I've been watching that. That's a nasty looking radar signature.
Yeah, listen to this tornado warning. Another severe storm is quickly approaching from the west. Those responding to reports of injury or damage in and around Medford should be prepared for another storm. That's not good.
Yeah, this is pretty nasty looking stuff here. Goodness. But anyway, we'll tell you what. Let's bring in JB for kind of a weather roundup. And that again, we're doing the show on the last of April, 2012. We've got some severe weather across the Plain States. By the way, let me ask JB, are you going out to the Talladega Super Speedway for race weekend?
I'm going to drive.
Ah, I knew it. You know, we got JB in that NASCAR deal, earlier this year, and he went around that trioval out there going 200 miles an hour, so he could clearly handle that. As long as we can get him in that car, man, you know, cramming JB into that window was kind of tough, but we got him in there. So
I've lost a lot of weight since that ride, and I thought we were doing 800 miles an hour.
It felt like it. My nose, in fact, is still bleeding. But JB, let's get a weather roundup. What's happening around the Fruited Plain?
Okay, USA extremes, but first this Alabama extreme. April 2011, record number of tornadoes in Alabama. April 2012 ends in a few hours tonight, and not a single tornado in Alabama for April 2012. That is absolutely remarkable. Last time Alabama had a tornado-free April was in 2004. That's based on some information from John Deebach at the National Weather Service. Activity in the Plains tonight, we've been talking about. There's a lot of that. Tornado watches extend from the Texas Panhandle across Oklahoma Panhandle and northward into the western half of Oklahoma, southeast Kansas, northeast Oklahoma, and the southern half of Kansas. Severe thunderstorm watches over a good part of West Texas, almost all of Ohio and Kentucky. There is a mix of rain and snow in the northwest and heavy snow in northwest Wyoming, including Yellowstone National Park. Make that Jellystone if you're a yoga bear. The Grand Tetons also getting heavy snow. The hottest in the country today, 106 in Death Valley. The coldest this morning, 17 at Serenade Lake in upstate New York, and also at Big Pony, Wyoming.
Is that it, JB?
Yes, sir.
All right. I'm sitting here looking at some of these reports. I see now that they're reporting major damage in Medford, Oklahoma tonight. So we kind of watch this thing unfolding as the show's been rolling along here.
And where again, is Medford located?
It's about the northern part of the state, JB. That's near the Kansas border up there. Uh-huh. So it's pretty far north of Oklahoma City. So we'll keep an eye on that. But you know what we got to do? We got to check that email inbox with Kevin.
Letters. We get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters.
All right, Kevin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Let me see here. Oh, you know what? First, we need to mention, did you know it was Dave Phillips' birthday?
Oh, really?
Skydiver's birthday.
He's the best. He claims he's older than I am. I don't know if I believe that because I'm old as dirt.
Yeah, only JB's older than you, right?
Only JB and Chuck Doswell. See, now that he's off the show, I can talk ugly about him.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that'll do you real well.
JB turned 80 this month. We all know that. Yeah, that's just fantastic.
Still feel like 55.
Well, there you go. Well, you look like you're 35, JB. You look like you're well buffed and a babe magnet and all that. So, hey, life's good.
Yeah. Happy birthday, JB.
Thank you.
80 is the new 55. Is that
there
what we're saying?
There you go. That's it.
I love it.
All right. Anyway, happy birthday to Skydaver. Also got a couple of notes from Tarmo Tenelsu in Estonia. He sent links. You know, there were two European tornadoes last couple of days, one in Toulouse, France, and another one in the United Kingdom. So he sent links along to those. That was very interesting. Wallace Williams sent along. James, do you know about this thing? This documentary film on the events of April 27th. Do you want to comment on this thing? I assume you're in it.
That's the one about the broadcasters, right?
Yes.
Yeah, this was done by Chandra Clark. Chandra used to be a producer here years ago. She's now in the world of academia. She got out in time. But anyway, she worked with some other folks in different colleges and institutions in Missouri and here and put together a short little documentary on the importance of traditional broadcasting during times of severe weather. In that, broadcasting's kind of in a tough patch right now with this change in the business model. And it's basically just kind of an effort to show that broadcasting still reaches a whole lot of people and it's extremely important during severe weather. So I thought that was a pretty good little piece they put together.
How do we see that,
I would assume it's on YouTube. We'll see if we can find the link to that and put it up. I'll dig for it here because she did send me a link and I'll look for it.
Oh yeah, please do, because I'd like to watch that. I think it would be interesting. But thanks to Wallace for sending that along. We got another note from Doug DeLifty. He was commenting on, now I've forgotten the name. What was the name of the UPS driver we had on? Tony? No, what was his
Jimmy.
Name?
Jimmy.
He was making some comparisons, was looking at some of the aerial shots and also the picture that you guys put on your blog that Jimmy had taken. But he just was making a comment that he thought he could see on some of the aerial shots and sort of make a comparison to the damage seen from the ground and some of the aerial pictures. And he just thought it was pretty striking and appreciated having Jimmy on the program. So thanks to Doug for that note. And a bunch of WeatherBrains listener surveys this week. One from here where I am in Arlington, Texas. Tong Pao was the name associated with the email. Said he started listening right after this April 3rd, I think it was, outbreak here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So welcome to a new listener, and thanks for taking the time to do the WeatherBrains listener survey. Mike Price also filled out the survey. That is at weatherbrains.com. He is from Hunterville, North Carolina. He's been listening for a while, and he found us from Leo's network, from the Twit network. So thanks to Mike and also to Leo. Heath Schroeder is a new listener, so welcome, and give us a couple more episodes, and we'll try not to run you off, and eventually you'll get hooked. Colin Lord from Blacksburg, Virginia. He says he likes hearing about the severe coverage that we do on television, especially against programming. I know James talks a lot about that. You know, it was we joke about the Dancing with the Stars program, but did you have more trouble with prime time, or did you have more trouble with Oprah in the afternoons when she was on, James?
Well, Oprah just kind of went. She went down in flames here, so her ratings were not that good toward the end. There's no doubt.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it was kind of dying on the vine. You know, the show went kind of political, and it just kind of got away from its roots. But there's no doubt for me the biggest issue. It's the prime time stuff. You know, and again, I don't watch a lot of television, but I know that Dancing with the Stars is big. What's the medical? I don't even know what the names of these shows are, but I know the ones that are painful to cut off. So this is mostly prime time.
And you get a lot of hate mail when you do that, right?
That is an understatement. I've got a big file in my email program called hate mail. Anytime I think I'm about to get a big head, I go right to that folder and it brings me right back down. And I know that I'm the scumbag that they say that I am.
That's funny. I didn't know you kept all those. That's very funny.
Oh, I do. Trust me. I think every broadcaster should. The easiest thing to do is hit the delete button, but just keep them because you might want to look at them one day.
Yeah, I know a lot of people that could benefit from that kind of a thing.
Dancing with the Stars is trash.
Yeah.
Now, JB, they're going to start sending you hate mail. You better be careful.
There you go. Yeah. Well, there's a little more inside baseball for you, Colin. Thanks for sending in the survey. And one more from Jacob Bauer. He is from Spalding, Nebraska. We appreciate you listening to the show. And we got emails from some of the regulars, Matt Graves, Matthew Romei, and Michael Moss. And that's it for the email bag.
All right. Hey, Ryan Hoke now. Let's bring him in real quick. Bill, are you still there, Ryan? Did you hang up on us?
I'm still here, yeah.
So let me try to figure this out now. All right. So you go to school in Starkville. You work in Jackson, Tennessee. You That's live right. in Louisville, Kentucky. How many miles do you have on your car?
I've put probably 45,000 miles on my car since 2009 when I started this madness of, you know, being from Kentucky, moving down to Mississippi, and then working weekends in Western Tennessee. So it's been absolutely crazy.
So you're saying you drive from Starkville to Jackson, Tennessee just to work a weekend morning shift every weekend?
You got it. That's exactly what I do. Yeah.
All right.
Now, I'm trying to add up the price of gas here. Oh, all right.
Yeah.
He's got to be making $400,000 a year out there to make this work, you know?
Yeah. He's got a Chevy Volt, James.
Oh, okay. Well, there. Yeah. Or a bicycle that goes real fast.
Now, Ryan, when will you graduate?
I'll graduate next May. So I've got exactly 1 year left here at Mississippi State.
Well, congratulations on already being down your career path. That's great that you're already working in a weekend job. And we know great things are going to happen for you. How'd you get interested in weather?
Oh my gosh. Well, like just about everybody else that we hear from, you know, you ask them what their childhood experience was with weather. You know, I got into weather when I was a kid because I was afraid of thunderstorms, and this sort of blossomed into an interest in why thunderstorms formed and where they were going to happen. And I was also interested in computers and maps and all sorts of other things. And then by high school, I had pretty much decided on this as a career path, and then broadcasting was added on later on. So yeah, it just kind of developed from a childhood interest in weather that eventually turned into a career path.
You know, Ryan brings up an interesting point. You have to wonder what other industry, if any, has so many people in it that were afraid of it for one reason or another when they were young. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Because, I mean, when I was 5 years old, I used to, you know, go straight to the basement anytime a siren went off or there was a tornado warning and anything like that. And then eventually that turned into an interest. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a parallel in other industries. That would be interesting to find out. Oh, well.
Yeah,
we'll have to think on that one, Kevin, because I sure can't think of it off the top of my head. But Ryan, you also, we always like to tout the National Weather Association, and you're the first ever student member of the Broadcast Meteorology Committee. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, that's right. Back in October in the NWA meeting there in Birmingham, I was selected to be the first ever student member of the Broadcast Meteorology Committee. And of course, I get to work with some great folks in there. Jackie Jarrus from CNN, Dave Freeman from KSN, and just a lot of great folks in there. And I really appreciate them picking me for this position. And hopefully the next meeting there in Wisconsin, we'll be able to get some stuff done, and should be a great time.
Now, talk about your storm chasing company that you work with. I know you're probably laying low when Chuck was starting to ramble down the storm chasing business project. Yeah. Sure, you were certainly laying low like you would be if there were some golf ball sized hailstones in the vicinity, but it looks like you came out pretty unscathed there, because it sounds like he may do that some too for a company. But tell us about yours.
I'll tell you what, I was relieved when I heard that he was a guest lecturer for another company, because, you know, I have a parallel there with me there. But yeah, since the 2008 season, I've been helping lead these tours with Storm Chasing Adventure Tours, and they basically just found me out of the blue. I was running a weather website, just kind of a basic, you know, weather forecast website for the Louisville, Kentucky area when I was in high school, and the leader of Storm Chasing Adventure Tours found this website, emailed me, and said, "Would you like to come on board with us?" And I said, "Why not? This is great experience, and I get to learn on the fly." So, of course, I cracked open all the storm chasing books, and I learned really quickly. And it's been almost five seasons. This will be my fifth season out there, and it's great to interact with all the tour guests. Of course, I give the morning briefings there on all the weather that's going on for that day and where likely we'll be headed to. And I try to emphasize education on these tours, because a lot of folks like to come out there and learn about weather. We get folks from all over the world, Australia, New Zealand, even over into the UK, and we had a couple from Spain last year. So it's a great experience to see all these folks out there, teach them a little bit about weather, and show them what nature can really do while doing it safely at the same time.
All right, let's do picks of the week here because you know the buzzer hits in just a few minutes here. So yeah,
we got a hard stop tonight.
We do. So let's roll the fog bank.
Initiating startup sequence.
Hello, WeatherBrains listeners. This is the fog bank trying to keep JB Foghorn free. I had sent him a link for April 16th, but he wasn't on, and he didn't use it on the 23rd. You can follow me on Twitter, at Skydaver, and send me your picks for the Fog Bank. You can find these picks at skydaver.blogspot.com. First up, from the Earth Science Picture of the Day, glaciating cirrus clouds near Asheville, North Carolina. Second, from the National Severe Storms Laboratory, an article on their phased array tests this spring. Third, a photo from Mike Hollingshead of a supercell and lightning at a truck stop in Nebraska. My fourth pick is a satellite photo posted by Brad Panovich, a rope of clouds along the outflow boundary of a front. And I'll close it out with an entry at Earth Science Picture of the Day, a fiery sunset over Cadiz, Spain. Thanks for listening. Skydaver out.
Initiating shutdown sequence.
All right, this is Picks of the Week. This could be a website, weather hardware, software, books, anything related to weather. Quickly, mine, it's a series of YouTube videos. We put out a DVD at the occasion of the one-year anniversary of the generational April 27th tornado outbreak in my state that killed over 250 people. And we put all those video elements up on YouTube, and I have a link to that. And that's my Pick of the Week. JB? Do you have a pick for us this week?
Yeah, and I had one question I wanted to ask Chuck Boswell, but I couldn't get it worked in. The one I pick, my pick of the week is the one that the gentleman just was speaking of. Earth Observation, NASA.gov, and it's a really, really interesting situation to where you can see the snow cover for the entire North American continent.
Awesome. Now, let me ask you this, JB. Now, when you go to Talladega this weekend, are you going to be over there in a Bluebird bus with a wife beater shirt up on the top of that bus in the infield?
I'm going to be barefooted with some overalls with the knees cut out.
Drinking Buffalo Rock beer. All right, Kevin, you got a pick for us this week?
I do. I'm going to read a short note from Andrew Thompson. He has been sending us pictures of Stewart's Orange and Cream Soda and other flavors. He said, I just finished listening to WeatherBrains and found the link to check out all their flavors. The pictures I took sent from my phone yesterday were in front of a great deli, bakery, wine, cigar, produce grocery store in Grand Blanc, Michigan called Oliver T's. He said, I highly recommend the smoked liverwurst and Swiss on pumpernickel bread, and you can get a pickle spear with it for free. Pickles, by the way, are evil, but that's my inset there. They sell all the varieties of Stewart's as singles in the cooler for $1.10 plus deposit. They were both great, the ones he had. Oh, the cherries and cream does not taste as good unless it's really cold. So my link is drinkstewarts.com/flavors, and it will be on weatherbrains.com.
Awesome. We need to send Stewart's an invoice for all this free advertising we're giving
them. I think so.
Brian Peters, do you have a pick for us this week?
I'm picking Chuck Doswell's blog on tornadoes of 2011. It's a wonderful read.
Ah, all right. Yeah. You know, Chuck is really opinionated and to some degree.
Really?
Chuck and I are like opposites and a lot of we're the opposites, but I love this guy. I mean, I just love the guy. I mean, his crankiness and his opinionated style. In his, you know, he's the kind of wise guy that'd be in the back of the classroom raising his hand. He just reminds me of me, except I'm not that smart. So, all right, let's see here. Ryan, you got a pick for us this week?
Yeah, my pick this week is a National Public Radio article about the amateur storm chasers from two weeks ago creating hazards in Kansas. Of course, we've seen the other articles from other big media outlets about, you know, the storm chasing problems from them. But of course, this one just focuses on the amateur storm chasers and what they did.
Awesome. And if you can drop a link to that in the chat.
Already has.
Okay. Oh, y'all are way ahead of me.
We're way ahead of you.
Producer JP, do you, sir, have a pick for us this week?
I do. A fantastic shot of the blossoming severe thunderstorms in Texas and Oklahoma. Just a great shot there earlier today. A storm chaser's dreaming. And for a slight risk day, you really wouldn't expect to see that. But what a surprise. I'm actually kind of wondering, should they have upgraded to a moderate here in the past few hours? What's your opinion on that?
You know, I've been sitting here glued to this show, and I have not been paying that as close attention. But out of one eye, I am looking at the radar, and I'm looking at some of the Oklahoma City television stuff. And, yeah, it's sometimes you get more than you bargain for out there this time of the year. So I agree. It's it'd be interesting to go in and see how many tornadoes they've had tonight.
Brian, if this was you, would you upgrade to a moderate? I just think it'd be one of those occasions where you'd upgrade. What would you do if you were in the seat pulling the trigger?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think the number justifies moderate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, there's strong storms out there. Don't get me wrong. It's just that they're fairly limited.
All right. Let's see here. We're getting close to our little buzzer deadline. see.
It's funny that we've been sitting here for an hour and a half, and somehow it feels short.
Bill, what's your pick and anything you want to plug here?
Yeah, James, next week we're going to have Chris Knowles from the National Weather Service in Paducah. He's going to be talking about polygonology, a new subject. And then Keith Stammer from Joplin, the emergency manager there, will be with us on May 14th. Mike Smith with AccuWeather has got a new book on the Joplin tornado on the 21st as we get close to the anniversary of that terrible storm. And then Cliff Mass, a professor at the University of Washington, as we take our hiatus from tornadoes and start to look at some other projects. And then, James, you're in charge of getting Joe Witte. I just keep moving him back. And I've moved him back to Monday, June 4th. So here's your chance to go.
I get emails from Joe all the time. Joe is awesome.
You know, we've had a lot of guests on this show, and nobody's ever avoided this as well as Joe. So
yeah. Well, that just shows you that he is a very smart guy, a very, very intelligent man. All right. We are getting out on time. For once, Weather Brains is the weekly show all about weather. We typically record this every Monday night at 8:30 Central Time.
Informative and fun, haven't you heard? It's a show for all you weather nerds. Weather Brains.
One more time.
Oh, yeah, Weather Brains.
To get in touch with us, the email address is email@weatherbrains.com. Our Facebook accounts and Twitter. What? What?
I have breaking news.
Oh, really? Oh, well, let's...
Yes.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Go.
Okay. Do you remember we had John Huntington on the show back a while back?
Yep.
Well, he and I have developed a kind of a little bit of a relationship, and I helped him. I helped with some quotes or some background for an article on weather and outdoor events. The article is about to be published in Protocol, and it certainly is timely because if y'all saw last week, there was a tent in St. Louis that was flipped by weather, and five people were in critical condition and one was killed. Now, it wasn't as big an event as the Indianapolis State Fair, okay, but it still was an outdoor event, and I'm sure it was a small event that had very little in the way of weather support to it, but it just shows, you know, how vulnerable we are when we're outdoors. His article is in the latest issue of Protocol. I haven't seen it yet, and that's a magazine that is devoted to outdoor event kinds of things. And John is storm chasing. He sent me a note just a couple minutes ago, says he made it to Davenport, Iowa tonight, hoping to chase something in western Iowa, Nebraska tomorrow afternoon.
Ooh. Oh. All right, cool. All right, guys, we are officially wrapping up again. Email at weatherbrains.com, and that's our email address. And thanks for listening. Have a great week. God bless. Anything else we need to do here? JB, are you through? Hey, what did you want to ask Chuck? You said you had a question. He's probably still listening.
I wanted to know if he was going to attend the next Southeast State Severe Weather Symposium at Mississippi State, because last time I was there and he was there, he sat in front of me with a big cowboy hat on and I couldn't hardly see.
Yeah. he wanted to know where you were for this one. Right?
Yeah, and the thing, I wanted to ask Chuck, you know, how do you wear a headset with that cowboy hat, man? I mean, it's just like, just something's not working here.
The cowboy.
But I was joking, that didn't really bother me, but I did sit across from him too down at the restaurant that we go to,
Pap's Place. Yeah, he went. He was there. You know, we had to miss him because of bad weather.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed being around him. He's very interesting.
All right, guys, we're in the news. I got to go.
I'm a little frustrated at him. He never answered the email thing.
Bye.